Hello there, and welcome to Sync Music Matters, a podcast that explores the beautiful relationship between music and the moving image. My name is Jim Hustrip, and I'm your host on this journey, as each week I seek to understand the people and the process behind the best music in TV, film, and games. I'm talking to composers, but I'm also talking to editors, music supervisors, directors, and anyone else who's involved with the synchronous process of pairing audio and visuals. And in today's ep, I'm talking to the wonderful Hannah Peel. Hannah is a multi-award-winning composer, artist, and producer. Last year, she won the Ivor Novello Best TV Soundtrack Award for her score to Sky's Midwich Cuckoos, starring Keely Hawes, having previously won awards with Royal Television Society and Music Producers Guild. She was nominated for an Emmy for her work on the documentary Game of Thrones, The Last Watch, and is a regular collaborator with people like Paul Weller. She's currently collaborating with Anne Nikitin, dabbles a little bit in theatre, including productions with Sadler's Wells, and if that wasn't enough, she's also a BBC Radio 3 presenter. Hannah Peel, thanks for joining me.
Oh, pleasure. It's great to be here. Thank you.
So I always get a little bit excited when Northerners come on. yeah. Don't ask me why, just obviously because I'm a Northerner. But you, whilst you have a Northern accent, you're technically not English, are you? Hail from Northern Ireland. Where do you consider yourself within that? Do you think of yourself as Northern Irish or Yorkshire?
Yeah, I know. It's a difficult one because I do sound so Yorkshire. And if I was back where I grew up in Barnsley, you would definitely hear the Yorkshire. But yeah, no, I would always class myself as Northern Irish, which is quite a confusing one for a lot of people. But it's my home for sure.
Fair enough. Well, I'm still excited, even though you don't technically class yourself as Northern. But so if Northern Ireland played Barnsley in a game of football, you would be supporting Northern Ireland.
God, that's a difficult one.
you can have a think about it. We'll come back to it. But I'll start where I always start, which is if we were to rewind to when you were a young girl, sort of around the age of 10 or whatever, if someone had asked you the question, what would you like to be when you grow up? What would you have replied?
Do you know, I think at that time I probably would have said a pharmacist, which is the oddest reply, I guess. My auntie runs and does still run some pharmacies in Northern Ireland, and as a part-time job when I was that age, I think she used to pay me a fiver for the day to go in and stand there and maybe dust some shelves because I was just desperate to do something, and I loved it. You know, like at the time she had this big old mahogany wooden counter with the big old till, you know, with the buttons that stand up on their own, and at the end of every day, she would, in my mind, mix the potions to go out to everybody. So I found it fascinating, and I was allowed to, like, you know, get the pestle and mortar and crunch up a few things. But I guess that's all I knew at that age. And I was doing music, but I was only playing it as an instrument in school. Never would have thought of anything else. Or maybe a detective. I would have liked to. Yeah, I was really into wanting to be a private detective.
Was there anyone? Was there the TV show or anything particularly that you watched, that Inspector Gadget or something like that?
Yeah, a little bit probably. But, you know, do you remember those big folders you used to get, and then you collected the magazines from W.H. Smith every week? And the one that I was really attracted to was like a spy collection. So then you would get the information of like how to make telephone, wire telephones and stuff, you know, in a child's language. But I thought it was just brilliant. I think that, and that whole scientific exploration, diving into stuff, finding things out, has stayed with me throughout my career and my life, actually. I really love researching and finding things. So that was a definite start to something there.
Amazing. So what was the progression then from, you know, aspiring MI5 agent to, obviously you were doing music in the background as a hobby, but how did that develop into a career that you're at today?
You know, I think school is great for some things. One of the things I benefited from was we did a week of work experience. And in Barnsley, there wasn't much to do, really, to be honest, especially if you wanted to do something creative. So I just chose something random for the 2 weeks and or the week, I think. No, 2 weeks, I think it is. But anyway, I chose to be in an accountant's office, and it was probably the worst experience I've ever had in my life. And I decided then at the age of 14 that I was never, ever going to work in an office and sit behind a desk. So, and I used to purposely forget my glasses so that they wouldn't make me do stuff, so that the whole time I was there, I spent it outside delivering letters and picking up errands and things. I just did not want to be in an accountant's office. So that was a very clear learning curve in terms of, like, I was in school band and everything at this time, but that was the thing. I was like, nope, I'm not doing anything that is like this. And I will probably end up working for myself, I think. So that was a good, so that's how I kind of, I guess, made the decision that, and also I just found that I was good at other things, but I just wasn't as good at other things. Like, everything I did always led back to music. So natural progression of going to study music was an easy option, really.
Mm. Playing to your strengths, I suppose. I'm interested because obviously growing up in Yorkshire as well, in Leeds, music was never really presented to me as a viable career option. It's something that had quite a convoluted path. I too made the decision I'm never going to work in an office. Unfortunately, I was in my sort of mid-20s by that point. But how did that journey happen? Because if your school was anything like me, it's like people don't really know what careers exist within the music industry. And it's, how did you progress through that and find a career?
Yeah, I'm smiling because I remember the careers office, you know, that you used to have to go to and tell everybody what you tell the person in there what you wanted to do. And I was presented with the army flyers of being in an army band. And that was the job. You know, there was nothing else available. It was questionable what I wanted to do. So
weirdly, in South Yorkshire, was there no option to sort of get involved with a colliery and sort of become a miner, and then you could join their band as well?
I know that's probably 10 years earlier or 20 years earlier, they definitely would have suggested that. So there wasn't, yeah. But I guess, like, what I knew from a very early age was that music in my Irish side of my family was very important and a social activity and a way to communicate. And in Barnsley, it was very much the same. You know, I learnt, first of all, the cornet, then went on to the trombone for years. And I was part of that brass band community for a very long time, doing the competitions and rehearsing twice a week. And you do realise that how amazing it is at feeling something, but also having fun at the same time. So I think what I've always searched for in my career, even though it's moved in so many different directions, is that there is always a feeling of, like, excitement and positivity. And whenever I've met a kind of a brick wall and stuff, I'll push it to a certain degree, but I'm very much of the kind of mindset of, like, okay, this isn't quite working, let's move on and move somewhere else.
Okay, that's interesting. So you quite quick to recognise, you can feel if something's not quite working, you don't get overly attached to it, and you'll move on to something else and get experimental in a different area.
Yeah, I think it's all about exploration and constantly pushing your skills, but also keeping that imagination open. I find that, I mean, how can we be really good at a job and love it still? You know, you go into music because you love it. It becomes part of your soul. And for me, it's always been that. It's never been a job. Like, I could never imagine going to work in an orchestra and playing and getting paid and going to the same place every week. Or, you know, just I find the different projects keep my spark alive and keep me interested in different things and part of the world and how I want to express stuff. So, you know, having albums and working with other people, on bigger shows, which are more demanding, I wouldn't be able to do that all the time. I feel like you've kind of got a part and parcel, really.
Yeah, sure. And obviously, as an artist or a singer-songwriter, essentially, it's you have freedom of creative expression to do what you want because it's your artist project. But when it comes to working to brief, or you're sort of collaborating with someone else for TV or film, I often find whilst people say that they want something very edgy and new and different, people are also quite attached to what they know. How do you bridge that gap of providing obviously the right thing, but also retaining that freedom to experiment and do something, you know, different or irreverent, if you will, whilst at the same time making sure that you don't freak people out too much?
That's such a good question. I'm so smiling because this is like I'm going through this right now where, you know, you're up against people wanting a certain sound. And I think the way I've shaped my career allows me to be artistically creative in a way that if there is a project that turns, for example, say you're working on something or like you think you go into it and people are like, we want sci-fi and we want like electronic sounds, and then it turns to a different direction. I think I've got to the stage where I'm not afraid to say, that isn't me, I don't do that. You know, there is a kind of a benefit to being able to say, look, you've hired me because of this, because of the artist, if you know what I mean, as well as just a composer. So I don't know if that describes that quite well, but I mean, I feel quite fortunate in that respect, and also quite confident in that area, that if something does go in a direction where people are more comfortable and they want kind of piano and then the strings, and that it isn't for me and I'm not in the right place. And to be able to comfortably say, you know, I have been through 20 years of not speaking up and doing jobs and then feeling like I've just been dragged through a bush backwards, and you kind of get to the point where you go, I never want to do that again. Whereas now I'm a little bit more like, actually, you know, if that isn't working out, that's not working. So we need to find a happy medium, or I need to leave because this is not what you need. So yeah, I mean, like, it happens all the time, like people wanting stuff that actually you weren't employed to do in the first place. And I guess it's all part of the projects in that respect. So it is quite nice to be able to then go and do your own album and feel like you've got creative control over that.
Yeah. And it's tricky, isn't it? Because when you first start out, it's very difficult to say no to work. You literally just take on everything. But actually there is definite merit to playing to your strengths and knowing. And has that been useful then for you, having a distinct artist identity? Because I suppose creatively people know what to expect, because you have obviously you're merging worlds as well, because whilst if your artist project is more synth based, then you are going into the realms of working with orchestras obviously. But does having that clear creative artistic identity help, do you think, in terms of people knowing what you're about and what you can do?
Absolutely, yeah. I think one of the things I learned when I graduated in Liverpool. I went to a college called Lipper, and a couple of years after I graduated, I'd done various different projects, mostly like live score to film, and then we would tour it, or I'd work in theatre, and I was teaching at the time. I was doing loads of stuff in Liverpool, and I decided that then I was like, I need to go and do a master's in film composition, and this is what I want to do. I've always wanted to do it from a young age. I've kind of always wanted, I just love the combination between visuals and music. And the only one I could find at the time was at the Royal College of Music. And I'd obviously come from a very pop background. And even though my scoring was, you know, I got a first in my degree and everything else, I didn't get in because one of the feedback they said was you're not classical enough, and I was like, well, bloody hell! Surely all film scores are not just classical. But somebody did ring me up after the interview, a young guy, and I wish I could remember his name, but he said, look, you obviously have a really good passion for it. You've got good melodies. You know what you're doing, but you need to find your sound and just go with it in that direction. Don't bother with this type of course. And I was like, wow, okay. So it was after that I kind of started to do the music box and make my own, make my own instrument so that I could then, and I just started off with it for a bit of fun, using it to to do covers of like the 80s classics like Tainted Love. And that was the thing that opened the door because people wanted to sync that. So through that, I met loads of supervisors. I got with a company who do a lot for licensing in Manchester called Woodwork Music, who were quite small at the time and now they've kind of really branched out. But yeah, that was the thing that opened the door. And it was because I'd just got my own sound. And I think, you know, as a whenever I'm talking to anybody about, you know, if they want to get into it and how do they find things, it's literally finding your sound. I think the trend at the moment, as you probably know, is that that producers and teams want something unique. And like what you say, they say, oh, we want something unique and edgy. And yes, it does end up sometimes being dragged a different direction. But ultimately, if you've got your own sound, that artistic integrity will stay with you. And you'll always be able to kind of go back to it. Because also, like, you know, sometimes when you're working on productions, you can get dragged so many places that you lose track of yourself and lose track of what you intended to do. And sometimes you feel like when you're being asked to score a scene 10 times that actually you start to doubt yourself and go, am I actually any good at this? And I feel like I'm constantly in that state, but it's always the fact that I have records and I've got other interests going on that it keeps me sane and moving forward and wanting to do it again.
Yeah. And how do you retain that perspective then when you're in the thick of it on a project and you're scoring the same scene for the 10th time? How do you, because it is, you sometimes can't see the wood for the trees. What do you do to kind of regain that sense of perspective?
Exercise.
Right.
Yeah, go for a walk, do yoga, do something completely different. I've just started doing squash, which feels so old, like so 70s. But a bunch of friends in Northern Ireland were like, let's do squash. And I went and did it and loved it. And just, I think the power of getting rid of stuff. I used to run a lot when I lived in London. I had like Victoria Park on my doorstep and I used to be there all the time having a quick run, and I'm just not into it anymore and I don't really have that access to kind of a good path. So this has been the new thing. But yeah, generally if start the day doing exercise, and we'll go back to it if there is something, because you need to break away from it. Sometimes you end up like leaving your studio and you've got like a knot in your chest and you can't get rid of it because of the anxiety or the tension. Like at the moment, a lot of the scores I do have a lot of tension and a lot of darkness, and you need to somehow get rid of that.
Yeah, absolutely. I do quite a bit of trailer music and it's really intense, and if you sort of sit doing that for several hours you come out. And with the studios here, you can quite often tell when someone's been in there too long, because they'll come out and they have this sort of weird glazed look to their eyes, and you know it's like, okay, it's time to step away. And it is really important. It's very tempting to keep sitting there and flogging the horse to death, but actually there's something to be said from stepping away and doing something different. I always used to find when I was working from home that inspiration would strike whilst I was making my lunch, because I was having a bit of time off and I'd be making some lunch and all of a sudden these ideas popping into my head and I could quickly run upstairs and sort of put them in. But it's when you take your mind off it that you allow space for insights, I suppose. And just picking up on something you said there as well, you're talking about records, it's like, sounds like exercise is almost a source for this, but where do you go for inspiration, or where do you look for inspiration, creative inspiration?
Yeah, a lot of the records I've done the last kind of, at least the last 6 or 7 years have had a lot of different kind of, I guess people want to call them concepts, but they're where I am emotionally. So like Awake But Always Dreaming, which was actually the last, 2016 that came out, and that was the last record I properly sang on. Since then, it's been a lot more about using records to get more of the film work and TV work that I want to do in terms of instrumental exploration and stuff like that. But that one in particular was all about my grandmother and her kind of, you know, her, the depths of her Alzheimer's, and and where I was feeling and where she, and also putting myself in her position. And at the time when I was writing it, between kind of 2014, 2016, nobody was really talking about Alzheimer's as a thing, but also the power of music. So when I discovered that, you know, when she wouldn't remember any of our names, but she could remember song lyrics, and she was a singer for a very long time, that I just couldn't believe that this hadn't been kind of explored in a record before, like so fully. So yeah, there are like elements of each album having its own inspiration. And a lot of people would have said that's a concept record, but it wasn't. It was just that I'd based it around a lot more of the science behind why this disease was happening and why the music. And so I guess everything has kind of gone from there in terms of like, if I don't really have a boundary or a thought to what we're trying to explore, it could just amble. So like the inspiration could come from anything. Usually it's a story, or sometimes it can be just like the unfolding that I wrote for the Parrot Orchestra, who are based in Bristol, that came out in 2022, I think. Yes, it did. I'm losing track of the years. But, you know, that took 4 years to write. And a lot of it was me having time to spend with them as instrumentalists, that looking at their strengths, what, you know, I'd never worked with, like, say, Braille, or I'd never worked with a drummer that didn't play a kick drum. So there was a lot of kind of things of me trying to find out. But then also, like, you then go on a journey of trying to discover why you are interested in this project in the first place. What is it about this ensemble of people that makes you want to write a piece of music for them? And that, you know, then you kind of trace back the, that was for me, it was about human nature and the human form and how that kind of develops. And it, you know, it's, I guess you could say that's a concept in itself, but I just find it, I'm just never going to write an album at the moment of full of love songs or anything, which I find incredibly interesting, but I just don't want to. So
no. Well, and again, that speaks to you having a clearer understanding of what you want to do. And I suppose that in that situation, like what, tapping into why you want to collaborate with these people, it's like if you technically in the first instance didn't want to, that journey would be very difficult. Difficult to find a reason. But and yeah, that speaks to, you know, knowing what you want to do and selecting it carefully. And in terms of you talking about that, because I was talking about that, I can't remember, one of the interviews we did was talking about the idea of finding your creative voice, or somebody actually phrased it differently. They said hearing your creative voice, because the idea of finding it suggests that it's outside, whereas actually hearing it is like it's already in there. It's just a matter of hearing it. Was that something that came quite naturally for you, or do you feel like it was quite a long journey of trying to uncover it?
Yeah, I feel like it's been a long journey. You know, some people are lucky and they hear or find their voice when they're quite young, and You always kind of look at 17, 18 year olds that are doing really well and they've got albums out. And I was like, I just did not know. I didn't, you know, it took me until I was in my mid 20s to even start to think about that. So, and then it kind of unfolded, like in terms of my 30s have definitely been about me and my sound, but it took my 20s to kind of realize that, because I spent so long playing for other people. Like I was doing session work all the time and gigging for other people and touring and supporting other artists, and I learned a lot, but it doesn't enable you to go, okay, this is what interests me. You need time to craft and discover and see what really finds you. And actually I feel like because of my session work, and where I ended up at the time was, I got introduced to synthesizers, and once I entered into that world, and that was via John Fox, who was in the band Ultravox. And, you know, John's very understated for the amount of work he's done and the amount of inspiration he's provided to me has been incredible. I class him more as a mentor, because if he hadn't have said, I want you to play synths and sing and play the violin all at the same time and come up with all the synth sounds, you know, at that I probably wouldn't have gone down that track so quickly. But it was when I started to play synthesizers that I started to use my hands and be very tactile and create sounds, and found that I could instantly and very quickly create a sound from a record in the 70s and 80s. And not that I understand much about filters and EQ, just, you know, LFOs. I know how to use them. I don't understand it. But I seem to be very natural at it. So, yeah.
So does that imply then that you, because I always think with composers or musicians as well, but there are certain people who are kind of more theory led and then other people who are more led by the ear. Does that suggest that in terms of like with the synthesizers, even though, you know, you don't know the in-depths of what's happening, you recognize the sonics and you know what you like and you know how to get it?
Yeah, definitely by the ear. And it's funny because when I was studying, I was probably one of very few at the college at the time that read music, and went there with, you know, having done my grades and reading music and very theory based. And when we got to the lessons that were improvised or where you had to be in a band and people were like, do you want to come for a jam? It would scare the shit out of me. Like, I just couldn't let go. I just didn't know. I would start shaking, sweating. It would be the worst thing at that point in time. And then, you know, now I'm doing gigs where it's just I stand on stage and completely improvise from the word go, and it couldn't be any different. But at that point in time, it's different skill sets, isn't it, and different ways of developing. But finding that voice, finding everything took a long time. It's not an instantaneous thing.
No, and it sounds like. It's inferring from that, it almost sounds like that was the sort of journey from your 30s and the 20s was the live stuff. And whilst, you know, it wasn't an active part of uncovering your sound, everything that you were doing was inspiring you and taking you on a journey, and all of that eventually fed into you then hearing that creative voice later
on. Yeah, and I feel really, I don't regret my journey. And yeah, I think it's just part of life, isn't it? All infuses things you've experienced, and I sometimes, you know, there's that whole thing around, well, you've got to be in turmoil to be an artist, and I definitely went through turmoil and thought this was my calling, but all the things I wrote, if I've gone through bad times, are absolute shit. Like I've always found that the music that when I'm in a really good place, and then I can reflect back and then try to understand and kind of dive deeper to why stuff happens, always makes better music.
Yeah.
But it's so personal to anybody, really, but that's my opinion.
Yeah. Yeah, there is this sort of cliche of the struggling artist, and it's this, but it's, I think it's Elizabeth Gilbert in, I think, Big Magic, the book, she talks about, you know, there is generally a struggle in creativity because you're wrestling with ideas and it doesn't always happen straight away. But that's not to say you have to be having a horrible time in life in order to create. It's just that there's a struggle in the process sometimes.
Absolutely.
But actually, yeah, it seems to me that the more grounded and present and better space you are in, that creates a better place for creativity than you know, struggle and chaos and turmoil. Although you know, that's not to say that, you know, things can't be taken from that and put into creativity in some way.
Definitely.
We'll talk about influences in a bit, but this is probably a good time to go under the skin. Under the skin. And have a little chat about Silent Roar. Is it out yet or not?
It's been playing at film festivals this year, so it's still looking for its distribution, I think, at the moment. That might change. I'm not in the know of what's happening, but yeah, it's been done various many screenings for distributors and many audience screenings as well. So
okay, give us a brief synopsis of the film.
Yeah, it's a first-time feature film by Johnny Barrington, who's from the Isle of Skye, but he's based in Glasgow. He's written and directed it. And his work is incredibly dark comedy, I would say. But he always has a sense of humility as well, I think. But yes, very quirky, very odd, and this film is no different. So he's done a lot of short films and won quite a few awards for his work, but this is his feature film, and it's set in the Outer Hebrides. But I mean, you could, by the way it's shot and the costumes, it could be anywhere, just on a very wild, rugged coastline. It was filmed on the Isle of Lewis, and it's about a young boy who loses his father to the sea. His father was a sailor, and he discovers that by surfing that he can try to get in touch with him, or try to find him effectively, because he believes that he's still out there, he's still alive. And it's about his journey with the sea and his relationships that evolve through that, through school, and also his dealing with grief. So there is a lot of comedy elements, life about being a teenager, a very awkward one. It's shot on film, which is stunning, especially in the sea, the, like, you know, hence the silent roar title. And the shots underwater are just beautiful, combined with this almost like, if you've seen Sex Education, that kind of look where the clothing and the look of the school, you're not quite sure what era it's set in. And this is the same sort of feel. I feel like this is a kind of lost cult film that has been made or just rediscovered, even though it's only just been made. But yeah, it's got a very odd sense to it. But the music was incredibly fun to write for it. And I've never written for any type of comedy at all, but I really loved the script. And I loved Johnny and the producer, Chris Young. And I just thought, you know, I want to have a go at this. So,
so what was the starting point then? What, you sort of get the scripts? I mean, did you wait until you had footage to start writing, or did you sort of come up with ideas? What was the process? Where did you start?
Yeah, on that particular project, they were quite well into filming and part of the editing as well when I came on board. So I think they were going to use this one album from a trombonist in Glasgow called Davour, and he had recorded his trombone in sea caves in the Faroe Islands. And Johnny had this idea that he was going to use solo trombone for the whole film. And naturally, as they started to progress, they were like, the solo trombone does not suffice for a whole film score.
So, yeah, limiting at times.
Yeah. So I was brought in because of the Colliery Brass Band record I'd done. And, you know, as I think also with the Game of Thrones soundtrack being quite acoustic-y, it had a positive feel to it that they wanted to explore. So actually the soundtrack ended up being a combination of around about a 12-piece brass ensemble, very kind of northern sounding, mixed with marimba, jangly guitars, percussion. We even recorded a vocal choir called the Dunedin Consort, who are like a baroque vocal ensemble. They're based in Scotland and in London, but I wanted sounds of the sea to be like sea nymphs. And so they were doing sounds of like what I've described as like ticker tape, kind of like, but it became, it almost felt like over the sea, it became like the foam of the sea. So it was a very broad mix, but I think it worked with this almost, yeah, indescribable kind of wild landscape, but also had an element of sunshine as well. Like, you know, he believes that his father's drifted down to Tenerife and is enjoying life within the palm trees. Doesn't quite realise how far Tenerife is, but
yeah, it's got a long way to go without getting eaten by fish and sharks. It's interesting there, because you're taking the choir, you're taking the brass band, you're bringing these sort of cross-pollinating these different I suppose, musical backdrops. I think something that's quite apparent in a lot of your work as well is the sound design. It always feels like you're looking for kind of unique sonic textures with things around you. Was that something you brought into this score as well?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, it's funny, isn't it? Until somebody tells points that out, you don't quite realise that you do that. But I very much like, as a starting point, even if it's just a palette to make stuff, even if it becomes a drone in the background that then gets taken out, there is always an element of creating stuff to sit upon, and then using that to then add an effect. And, you know, the TV show The Midwich Cuckoos, a lot of people thought that the sound design, it was sound design, but it was the music. And there was very much a blur between the both of them. And that is very much what I do with composition. I find it quite interesting to use things that push something that isn't just an instrument. And yeah, in Silent Roar, it's definitely there, but more with the voices, actually. There was a lot of kind of affecting and... yeah, the production is always really important for me.
Yes, as I was going to say, I think that's obviously within what you're talking about earlier, within the strict realm of composition, you tend to sort of think of working with traditional instrumentation and writing for orchestras or sections or whatever. The production side of it is, and obviously you have that with the, to a certain extent, the sound synthesis, but the production is where it's like, it's interesting with just going around a room and finding unique things to tap or bang or textures to bring in. And I love that. I think it's interesting you say about blurring the lines between music and sound design, because I do feel that's where really interesting things start to happen. And it's great, I suppose, when that's done so flawlessly that people think, you know, oh, that was great sound design. No, that was all part of the music.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's amazing. I was really lucky on that project, Midwich Cuckoos in particular, because Harry, who worked on that, was an incredible sound designer, has done loads of things on Doctor Who and other things. And he was very, very much up for the collaboration. And so, you know, we had a very good conversation about a lot of back and forth. He would deliver me the sound as soon as he'd done anything. So I knew where he would take more of a highlight, and then I could come in and do other things. And that, I've never had that fluidity since or before. It's been very much like the sound designer does their thing and I've done mine. But yeah, there is an element of always wanting that again, because I find that really exciting, and it should be seen as one department rather than as separate entities.
Yeah, absolutely. And to be honest, I think the work, to have that communication and that exchange is probably really important, because I've done short films before where sometimes the sound design and the music end up competing with each other, and you sort of think, well, if I'd known that the sound design was going to be so intense there, the score would probably have been pared back, you know, quite
absolutely,
a lot. So to have that, it just like it leads to, I think, probably the optimal balance between the two. But then, yeah, it depends on how much contact you have, I suppose, and how open the sound design guys are to.
Yeah, and to also collaborate. Like timing, like I think that's really essential, especially on, and especially for TV. I think it's slightly different with film, but you just seem to have a little bit more time. But with TV, like Midwich was very lucky in that it worked out like that and it stuck to the schedule and the production side of it went smoothly. Whereas, like, you know, sometimes you're just thrown in, and it seems to be more this last year that there is no lock of film. Like, you're constantly writing to changes in the edit, which is insane. Like, it feels like you're actually going mad. So already you've got a job where you have to write a lot of music, but then on top of that, you're then rewriting it again. So yeah, it's less time to talk about how something is working with the sound designer, I feel. And it's a shame. Like, it could be a lot easier. But anyway, we'll see.
Yeah. And how do you manage that? Because I often think that time pressure generally can stifle creativity. And obviously with TV, there is generally that can happen. How do you mitigate that time pressure and not sort of running out of time or feeling like you're having to compromise artistically?
Yeah, that's a wonderful thing to think about, because actually, like, it just changes all the time. But I've found the last while that if I don't do the work before, it's a lot harder. So coming up with loads of ideas that people can use in the edit, the editors can take from, if that isn't there, you've got a really hard job. And I worked on a film last year where actually that wasn't there because the time constraints, there was no time to play, basically. And halfway through the project, I had to stop scoring to picture and just go, I'm not doing anything for 2 weeks. I'm just going to play and just write a load of music that's nothing to do with what's happening on screen. And that was the only way to get through that project. And so actually the TV show that I'm working on currently, I've been lucky enough to have the script quite early on, have those conversations, come up with loads of ideas that can then be utilised throughout, you know, to kickstart stuff, to just kick ideas off. And that means, so, you know, I think, like, yes, you can get stifled with creativity. And actually that same principle of stepping away and going, like, there's, you know, for example, the last 2 days I've been struggling with a cue that I can't quite get a hold of. And because I'm looking at the temp music and I'm looking at the footage and I'm going, ah, this is not, why can't I do as good as this? And what I've had to do is obviously go back to the beginning and scrap it, not write to picture, just write a piece of music that I like, and then take that piece of music and edit it to the footage. And that's the only way I've been able to get around it. Otherwise, you just go mad.
Yeah, it's so funny because I think sometimes when you're trying to, obviously being mindful of what's happening on screen is part and parcel of the job, but sometimes it can be problematic, can't it? It distracts you. And to actually switch off the imagery and go, okay, what's the underlying emotion? What are the feelings? What is it I'm trying to convey here? And do that without being beholden to what you're seeing on screen is quite liberating.
It is, and it inspires you, and you go, like, I wrote something last night and I came back to it today. And what I finished last night and went to bed really, really gutted. I was like, what I've written is awful. I'm really struggling with it. I don't like it. I'm rubbish. You know, all these things that you go through, this struggling artist thing. And then woke up this morning, did my yoga, did my normal thing. I wasn't going to change that routine. And then came back to the studio and I was like, oh, actually, that's really good. I really like it. And it's just, like, perspective. And there's I can't remember who said it, but it was brilliant. Maybe Dylan Thomas or someone like that, who said they always stop writing at the point when they feel like it's going really well, so that you then come back the next day and you are there in that headspace going, this was really great, I'm going to continue with it, which is a really hard thing to do. Yeah, sometimes you don't know when to stop, do you? Or
no,
you can't,
absolutely.
But
yeah, and thanks for sharing that as well, because I think it is, for any creative listening, it's reassuring to know that it happens to everyone, that you can you can go to bed sort of thinking this is rubbish and all this sort of imposter syndrome creeps in and
yeah,
you feel terrible about it. But then with fresh ears and fresh perspective the following day, you go, oh, no, actually, that's really good. I really like it. And it's testament to the fact that your mind state at any given moment will hugely influence the, you know, the lens through which you're listening to a piece of music. So
absolutely,
I think,
yeah,
it's always reassuring to know that everybody faces that same struggle. And interesting as well about what you're saying about the prep work, and this is something I spoke to Stephen Harron about his Dark Materials, and he was saying that Lorne Balfe, who scored that, this seems to be quite common much more common in TV nowadays, is that essentially composers will submit a whole suite of music for the editor to edit to and to use. So therefore you end up, I suppose, first of all, it gets you ahead of the game because you know what cues are working and what aren't. But it also means hopefully you are trying to, there's less, the temp tracks are your own music rather than someone else's. Because there's that old problem with temp tracks is that people get very used to hearing things a certain way, editors, directors, and then anything short of that exact piece of music it's very difficult to sell them on your cue. But if the editor has scored something with pretty much entirely your music that you've submitted in advance, I think that probably makes the process a lot easier.
Yeah, Yeah, absolutely. It does. Yeah. I always find it quite gutting when you've submitted loads of stuff and then they still don't use it.
Yeah.
Which can happen. but yeah, it does help massively.
Yeah. I suppose you could reconstitute it at some point. Do the cues that don't make it ever make the albums that go out of on commercial release on Spotify or what have you? Or is it purely the cues that were chosen?
I can't think of anything directly, not with albums. I think they do make it to other film and TV projects. Like, for example, when it was lockdown in 2020, I must have pitched, for 4 or 5 different projects within the space of maybe like 2 or 3 months. I think there was that period where there was a lot of people pushing for projects and then wanting them to come into action once things were back to normal. But what we found obviously was we weren't back to normal for a long time. But and because I was pitching, I was writing a lot of music, and there was melodies and a couple of themes that I'd used for a pitch for a film which I didn't get that became one of the main things in Midwich Cuckoos. So it, you know, that recycling is really important. There's always a hope that it doesn't, you know, you can save something. And I still have like a melody on the piano in my head that I've had for probably 10 years that still has not been used for something. And I'm waiting
one
for
day,
that day.
One day.
It will get used one day. It's so lovely. Mm. And I've tried it on an album and it doesn't work. And so it's definitely written for some kind of romantic Italian scene somewhere.
Yeah. So do you have a hard drive on your folder, which is basically your sort of ideas box with lots of,
Yeah,
all
definitely.
This stuff they never made it.
Also, like, it's just easier to start if you've not got a blank page. So even if you scrap what was there originally and you could go in a different direction because you've saved it as something else, but, you know, it's just easier to start with something.
So we'll touch briefly on The Scoop as well, which is what you've just been working on with Anne Nikitin, which is out later this year. Can you tell us a little bit about that, little teaser?
Yeah. Well, firstly, to work with Anne Nikitin is amazing. She's an incredible composer and very fun to work with. But we were both asked to collaborate together. We'd never worked together, but because of time frames, as always, the production team realised that they probably would need 2 composers to get through it so fast. So Scoop is based on the account of the producer who put together the interview, the Prince Andrew interview, that famous interview where he said he doesn't sweat in regards to Jeffrey Epstein. And they've made a film out of it with Gillian Anderson and Billy Piper and Rufus Sewell as leads. And it's really wonderful. And it's something that I never would have thought I would score, that kind of soundtrack level, I guess. It's a very different sound world for me. And I think the combination of myself and Anne were able to kind of cover a lot of basis, and I learned a lot from her, and I think vice versa. I'd hope so, anyway.
And what's the dynamic there then in terms of how do you go about, because obviously you've got a certain way that you tend to do things, your creative identity, she has hers. How do you find that middle ground, and how do you organise yourselves in terms of bouncing ideas off of each other?
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting, isn't it? Because I think back now and I go, God, how did we start that? But we did find that place that we got to that had a kind of unified voice. And yes, there was a lot of kind of back and forth at the beginning of like, what sounds are we going to use? But fortunately, because the production had been working heavily with temp music, they'd already established a kind of sound world, and it was then about us then making that sound world ours. So there was already a kind of emphasis on unusual kind of bells, waterphones, percussion in a very weird way. We tried as much as possible to stay away from the voice and piano, but, you know, it did end up in the as it always does, but only very slightly. But one of the first things that we did was Bei Bei Wang, who I've worked with before and will continue to work with throughout this year. She's an incredible Chinese percussionist. And I said to Anne, look, let's book a session. Let's record her doing various things to different tempos over, you know, very loose drafts of stuff. And we basically, you know, used everything that she did. All the bells, she brought water percussion, she dipped cymbals into and bent the sound into the water and gongs, and used the Super Bowl percussion sticks to make these great sounds. So a lot of it was us then making a toolkit out of her and then placing her on the film. So that gave us this kind of solid sound for the basis, and then we could do whatever we wanted on top and take it in directions. But yeah, finding the kind of the theme and stuff took a long time and a lot of back and forth until we eventually got it.
Nice. And it sounds like, again, that was the that unique sonic texture that you found with Bei Bei Wang was kind of at the heart of it, and then you're sort of building around it.
Yeah, because it's a weird one that, you know, the film itself is like a kind of real in-depth look at the BBC and the royal family. So the kind of normal thing would be, oh, okay, it's got status, you need an orchestra. And actually, Sam, who's the main character in it, is like, you know, just against the grain in every aspect of the typical BBC and a kind of like a converser with the royal family. So it was good. The percussion and everything else worked out really well of describing her story of like how she put it all together.
Yeah, amazing. That sounds exciting. So that's to come this year, 2024. Yes. Awesome. Well, that's probably a good segue into getting a taste.
Getting a taste.
I often think, and we sort of touched on it earlier, but we are very much shaped creatively by our influences, particularly during the time period, maybe of from 10 through to sort of 20s, like the music or the art that we consume goes some way to inspiring how we create ourselves. Are there sort of particular influences that you can think of people that could be bands or they could be artists that you think have really shaped who you are today as a creative?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. My mum was a teacher and we didn't actually have a lot of music in our house, weirdly, considering that my dad plays guitar and sings and my grandfather was, but in the actual house there was no kind of like record collection or so. Actually, when she used to bring home my mum kind of educational packs from school, sometimes they'd have like the tapes that came with them. So there would be like Holst, The Planets, for example, and I put that on cassette and I was just instantly blown away. Like, you know, those sounds that it will never leave me, the impact that I felt once I heard that come out of the stereo. But we had a great neighbour who was into music and had a very good vinyl collection and a great surname. He was called Mr. Boocock. And he said to me, I have a record for you if you promise to take care of it. I think I must have been about 8 at the time. And it was The Greatest Hits of the Carpenters. And as soon as I put that vinyl on, you know, obviously shown how to do it and heard it coming through and saw it spinning on the record player, heard the song Why Do Birds, it just sent shivers down my spine to the point where, oh, yeah, I mean, it's the kind of song that just, as soon as you hear that voice, like it just makes you want to cry. And I just, that was the first time I ever felt those emotions. And throughout my teenage life and early 20s and late 20s, but like vocals were always very much a part of my music background, like culturally, either playing in bands or playing with friends, it was always based around songs and singers, and that eventually led on to Joni Mitchell. And you know, I absolutely adore Joni Mitchell's work, but also like I think then the other side of it is the Holst side has then led on to things like Ennio Morricone and people like Bernard Herrmann that I just, although I don't write music like that, I find it so inspiring. It just lifts you to a different place. And it's that lift that I find really exciting.
Amazing. And what about, because I often think, particularly with anything, particularly when it comes to scoring film, I always talk about Star Wars. I think for me, Star Wars was this incredible thing, and I think a huge part of that, and didn't note at the time, was the score. Are there any particular film scores that stick out in your mind as being influential or almost just sort of seminal in terms of when you heard them, you went, whoa, what's this?
Yeah, I mean, like, there was always like the soundtracks that came out in the late 90s, that there was that kind of run of soundtracks that were led by songs, weren't they, more than the soundtrack. And, you know, like Romeo and Juliet, like, changed my perspective as a teenager of what could be potential in films. But the Deborah's theme in Once Upon a Time in America, Ennio Morricone's score, that moment that you hear the theme and he's looking through a hole at the girl dancing in with the dust in on the wooden floor, and the music is just, I think at that point when I saw that film, I was just like, that's it. That's the thing that tells you about the melancholy and the loss, but also like childhood and adulthood and the transition. And I think that feeling has always stayed and always that kind of reflectivity of stuff. And I don't know whether that's because I was always moved about as a child. We were either in Ireland or we were in Yorkshire, and there was always this kind of reflective nature of when you were in the other place. But yeah, that moment and that piece of music, I just think is incredible. And apparently it wasn't even going to be used. It was just a theme that he had from a different project that wasn't used in that. So he put it on this and it worked perfectly.
Wow. Yeah, that's amazing. And it's interesting listening to you talk as well, because it's all about it. It's music eliciting a really powerful emotional response in you. And I think this is ultimately what you do, what we do is it's about creating that emotional response, eliciting that emotional response in somebody and heightening that sense of emotion, heightening that sense of engagement or connection with the visuals. And it's really powerful.
Yeah. I think I think, you know, that's why I watch films.
Yeah.
You want to be moved, don't you? You want to escape to a different place. I have a lot of respect for other composers and what they do. But like a lot of pop music, it's like fast food. And I find that I don't react to it. And you need it there, because if you were just filled with emotional music all the time, you'd start to just wince away from it probably, but yeah, it's those moments that you're constantly looking for. It's like I wrote the Mary Cassio album, which is the brass band and synthesizer record, and the one of the tracks in that, in fact, Sunrise, it's called Sunrise Through the Dusty Nebula. It's like the second track on the record, and what happened was, when we did it live with the brass band and, you know, 30 players breathing at the same point, was this moment of that thing where you get the shivers down your spine and it makes you want to cry, because like actually it's so overwhelming. Like it's just sound that just it moves in a certain way, and it was almost like I was like, did I write that? Because, you know, you don't think it when you're working with MIDI. Sometimes it just takes the live instrumentation to make that happen. And I think that's why, I don't just work in electronic music. I do find that I have elements from other stuff that is always at play, because it's that, and now my brain's gone blank. Who wrote
The Humanity.
Yeah, but who wrote Chariots
of Fire, Vangelis,
of course. He always... has a lot of quotes, but always said about the combination of synthesizers and orchestra, and that there should never be a distinction between them. A synthesizer has every right to be in an orchestra as a violin. And I always agree with that. I think in the right context and written in the right way, it does, it works.
Yeah. Well, and as well, I'm always a staunch advocate of, not necessarily just with synthesizers, but certainly the more we work in the digital realm and we do use MIDI and electronic elements, there is an organic feel and nature, a humanity, particularly to someone playing an instrument or singing or what have you, it just adds something that can't be recreated through electronically. You know, that is as good as virtual instruments get, you know, having somebody playing it live. It always blows my mind in terms of I can work with MIDI and get it sounding as realistic as possible in the production and the mix and everything. And then as soon as somebody plays it, it's like there's just another layer of life, of texture, of something that's added by having a real human being on the record as well. But that's where beautiful things happen, is where you can combine the sort of almost perfect digital realm and then the imperfect organic analog realm as well.
Yes, yeah, makes it exciting.
Yeah, absolutely. And just quickly on the science thing, because you mentioned sunrise through the nebula?
The dusty nebula.
And there's particle G1, and there's a number of, like, when you go through your track title, particularly for your own artist work, there's a lot of scientific, for want of a better word, geekery going into the into the titles. Where does that come in? What's this, the sort of science element and your fascination with that?
Yeah, I guess like it is the I guess that exploration that we talked about at the very beginning, the discovery of things, and I find the research really interesting. You know, that record in particular with the kind of the particle G1, and they were all just points on the map on the way to Cassiopeia, which my character at that time was on. So I guess like it's sometimes like I find I had to laugh because there was like this thing in Ireland, somebody posted crazy shop names and stuff like that, or business names, and play on words and puns, and kind of almost taking the mickey out of oneself, which is very much an Irish type of humour. You know, playing the lower card, but by making somebody laugh, you end up kind of, it elevates, you know, yourself in some senses. That's very much an Irish thing. But I realised that actually quite a lot of my albums and track titles are a play on words or puns or like evocative, like on my Furwave record is called Ecovocative.
Yes.
And I didn't realise this until I saw that and I was like, oh my God, what an idiot. But anyway, it seems to be something that I do, and I like the kind of making up of new words and things as well. So
I definitely noticed it, and I actually do the same with the names for cues. I will always try to do weird plays on words because I just think it makes the editor's life a little bit more interesting as well. It's like, oh, I wonder what this one's going to be called, something. But you get to the end, you get sort of three or four in with the puns, and they start getting really tenuous, that's sort of partly where maybe it becomes even more fun.
I named one today Grabby Granny.
Grabby.
There's a granny that grabbed something, and I was like, it just made me laugh. It just kept the lightness of the dark going.
Yeah, absolutely. Why not? Amazing. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to chat. I think that's probably the perfect place to wind it up. I do want to finish with the quickfire questions.
Well,
the first one. This is the deeper of the questions. Is what's your favourite biscuit?
Jaffa cake.
Is it technically a biscuit or a cake?
Oh, it's a biscuit. Comes in biscuit form. Comes in bite size. And also, it's not about the biscuit, really. It's about the process of eating it. It has to be eaten in a very certain way. So.
Oh, and what is this way?
Nibble around the edge of the orange jelly, then pick off the chocolate, then eat the jelly, then eat the cake.
Okay, so yeah, it's a bit like something, people have a similar process with a bourbon or a custard cream or an Oreo, don't they? There's a special way to go about eating it. Tunnocks,
yeah,
tikka, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I do pick off the chocolate of that, and it's so gross sometimes. I think, why have I done that? But then you scoop out the marshmallow, and then you eat the biscuit, and then you eat the marshmallow.
Interesting, yeah. But that assumes that each individual part is more delicious in isolation than it would be if you were combining.
Yeah, absolutely.
But there is a weird thing with Jaffa cakes, is that, I don't know whether this is, you know, scientific, but if So a biscuit, when you leave it out, will go soft, and therefore it's a biscuit. And a cake, when you leave it out, goes hard, so therefore it's a cake. And I think Jaffa cakes go hard.
Yeah, they do. I had some last night, and they've gone hard.
Oh, and they're not, I was really angry. They're not good crispy, are they?
No, I was really angry that I hadn't put them in an airtight tin.
Yeah, absolutely. You need to get your Tupperware collection out. What's a little known fact about you?
Although I haven't done it on this call, I don't know why sometimes, but I hiccup every day.
Oh, really? Every day?
Every day, yeah. It's a good, strong hiccup, and I say hiccup when I do it, and I don't know why. It's just ever been there since I was a teenager. But yeah, I do have the hiccups every day. I don't get it when I'm doing a concert or like this interview.
Recording vocals.
Yeah, I just don't get it. So I think it is. I mean, hiccups are to do with your diaphragm. And so maybe when I'm chatting to somebody or I'm presenting or something, I'm engaging my diaphragm. And when I'm not, then I get the hiccups.
So it's normally something you can just be sat working on something and all of a sudden... I mean, is it an isolated hiccup, or are we talking an attack?
No, it's an isolated hiccup.
Okay. Well, there you go. The known fact. What scares you?
Cows.
Cows?
In a
really?
Field.
You've got a cow phobia?
Yeah. Not when they're behind their farming bars or behind a wall, but if I've discovered, because I've been spending a lot of time in North Yorkshire and a lot of walking, and I love walking, and I can just about get through a field if there's sheep in it, but if there's cows, I will have a panic attack. I just am so afraid of them, and I don't know what it is. I've never had it before, but yeah, the last kind of 6 months, it's been a phobia of cows in a field.
Yeah. Well, it's funny because I was walking around Harewood House over Christmas, and there's a section there where they've got a lot of sort of Highland coos, and there's a group coming through a gate, and they could see the cows ahead of us, and we just come through the middle of them. And there was a lady was very, very nervous. She was going, are they all right? are we going to be okay? Will they leave us alone? It's like, yeah, they should be fine.
I know. Reason points to the fact that they won't come near you and they're almost afraid of you. I know all these facts, but still I cannot face going through a field of cows. Like, I have to either stick to the wall if there's no other way round, or just always have an out. I think they're very inquisitive, and I think they're beautiful animals, like the beautiful eyes, but they're so inquisitive, and sometimes they just come towards you and I'm just like, you're going to kill me, you're going to kill me. So I don't know what it is, but yeah, currently it's cows.
There's brutal cows. And finally, what piece of advice would you give to your younger self?
Oh my God, so many different things. But I think this is just something that I've learned through time, and the way you're brought up is obviously a play on things, but I've always wanted, or when I was younger, always wanted validation of stuff. So like, if I did something, is that good? Have I done the right thing? And that's definitely formed a lot of my career, probably up until the last few years. But I still like the validation of stuff. And I just wish that if I could talk to my younger self, I'd just be like, you don't need it. Just take risks. Because I think I would have done a lot of different things in my life if I'd have just not needed that.
I think that's the important distinction, isn't it? It's because I think we all want validation, which is fine, but it's when you need it. It's when not having it becomes an issue, because obviously we're dealing, when you, particularly with anything artistic, it's highly subjective, and you know, one person might love it and another person might hate it. And something that interesting that Stephen Warbeck said about it, it's not that it's good or bad, it's just whether it's right or wrong for that specific moment in time.
Yeah.
Which, but yeah, if there's a lot of freedom to be had in not needing the validation.
And you can take it so personally if it's not there, and that's not, sometimes it's not good for you. I think, you know, personal decisions, relationships even that I've chosen have not been right because I've needed maybe somebody that worked in music, and it's just been like, why was that even needed? Like, it shouldn't be a part of things. And yeah, I do have a lot of respect for particularly younger artists and composers when they just go for things and they take risks on stuff. And I always feel like, God, I couldn't have done that at that age. I was so frightened by a lot of things.
Yeah. So, yeah, there's almost a sort of like a cockiness when you're starting out with sort of like, yeah, don't worry, I could do this. And it's, I think, funnily enough, as you go through your career, it's almost that you start to worry more about you. The more you understand how things work, sometimes the less you question your ability to do it. Whereas when you're starting out, it's like, yeah, that's fine. And maybe that hopefully it comes full circle and you realise, because it's hard to know your own merit, isn't it? It's hard to know, have the perspective to know that you are good at what you do and how good you are at what you do.
And I do think it's down to the way you're brought up, the cultural differences between certain people. And yeah, it's very much a Northern Irish thing is to be don't show yourself off, don't show yourself quite a lot of the time, because when I was a kid and my parents, they were in the Troubles, and you didn't want to stand out. You'd be taken down if you were stood out. So,
and then you ended up in Yorkshire, where it's very much about, rather than pursuit of the positive, it's about avoidance of the negative. So like the idea is like, would you like a cup of tea? Well, I wouldn't say no. Or how are you? I'm not bad.
Yeah. No,
I'm not committing to being good either. So it's sort of, yeah. Interesting cultural differences. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to chat. It's been an absolute pleasure. Wonderful pearls of wisdom and always very reaffirming and interesting to know your process. Where can people find you if they on social media and that malarkey?
Yeah, I'm there. I'm often tweeting about the Radio 3 shows and things like that. So there's lots of amazing music that we play on Night Tracks if anybody wants to listen in. Myself and another presenter, Sarah Moore Peach, we swap weeks on Radio 3. That's like 11 o'clock from Monday to Thursdays. There's an amazing amount of music that we play. A lot of I get a lot of my inspiration for different scores from the music that we play, just because I'm listening to so much a lot of the time. On Twitter, well, X should we say, Han Peel or Hannah Peel Music, I'm there.
Okay, amazing. And just quickly, what's the premise of Night Tracks?
It's late night listening, but a lot, actually, I say that most of our listeners actually listen back during the day when they're working, but it's, everything's got a kind of a pace to it. There's no silence, but it is music from all over the world, all different genres. We play things that are medieval right through to electronic, from folk to country to classical, but all with a kind of late night vibe to it. So you do get a lot of kind of experimentation and sound as part of that. And that's the vibe. There's usually some, because it's Radio 3, there is an element of having some classical instrumentation somewhere, or if there isn't, it will be kind of folded either side in the tracks with something, either a baroque choir or it's always got an interesting story, and a lot of the music we play is independent, so it's a lot of composers, artists that are not necessarily on a label that are being promoted with radio pluggers. A lot of the music comes from my producers and me finding stuff on Bandcamp and seeing somebody release something and I'll just be reading, you know, Facebook or something, and I'll be like, ooh, that sounds really interesting. I'll listen, I'll be like, perfect.
Amazing. Yeah. And I reckon you've got a great voice for late night radio as well, a sort of soft, warm, relaxing tone.
Thank you. Yeah, when I first started, there was a bit of a kind of backlash on social media of like, oh, these northern women are soft-spoken. I was like, that's just how I talk. Like,
as if you're putting on a voice for the duration.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, we probably were in the very beginning. It's been going for 4.5 years now, but there is a tone that we use that would be very slow. You know, like, hello, I'm Hannah Peel and welcome to Night Tracks. It's that kind of personable, very close mic
action.
Can you do quickly now? Can you do a, hi, I'm Hannah Peel. Welcome to Sync Music Matters.
Hi, I'm Hannah Peel, and welcome to Sync Music Matters.
Amazing. That's the new
that's my full broadcaster.
Yeah, amazing. Yeah, well, thanks again, Hannah.
See you soon. Welcome. Thank you very much. Bye.
Thank you very much for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, and given that you've listened this far, I feel you might have, then I would be honoured and incredibly grateful if you could take a moment to subscribe, rate and review on your podcast platform of choice. By subscribing, you'll automatically be notified each time a new episode drops, and by rating the show, you tell the artificial intelligence that will soon be running the world that this podcast is worth listening to. I certainly get a lot of insights and value from these conversations, and I genuinely hope you do too. If you'd like to get in touch with the show, then you can email me, podcast@larpmusic.com. larpmusic.com is my digital abode, and the home of the podcast is larpmusic.com/Sync Music Matters Podcast, and Sync Music Matters Podcast is hyphenated. Thanks again for listening, and until next time.